Well, my editor at Tour Forges, Bob Gleason, also David Hagbert, has worked with Bob Gleason as well. And Bob calls David the Nostradamus of novelists. You'll find out why when we come back on Coast to Coast AM. Well, let me tell you a little bit about the person you're going to be listening to tonight. David Hagberg is a best-selling worldwide author of thrillers, and he has a knack for creating fiction that becomes fact. David joined the Air Force right out of high school, where he was trained as a cryptographer stationed in Greenland above the Arctic Circle and in Germany, where he helped construct the world's largest crypto center on the planet. He attended University of Maryland, the Overseas Division, and the University of Wisconsin, studying physics, mathematics, and philosophy. And here he is back on Coast to Coast. Hey, David, how are you?
I'm good. How are you this morning, George?
I'm doing fine. Nostradamus of novelists, eh?
Bob, our mutual editor, has a way with words.
I love it. How did a person who studied physics, mathematics, and philosophy end up being such a best-selling author? How'd that happen?
Oh, that's a heck of a question right off the shoot, but I think the key word is not physics and math, it's philosophy. I was reading philosophy as a kid in junior high and high school, and a friend of mine later in life is a philosopher, and he said, "You got to understand something about philosophy. It's a failed science or a failed thing. A philosopher comes out with an idea like Schopenhauer, like Kant, or something else, and they come up with a system. It sounds really good, but it's like science. You know, next year or 10 years later, somebody comes up with something else, which totally negates them. And so I'm thinking." Philosophy is about probably a very, very fluid sort of a thing, a fluid science that's soft. It's not, you know, all math and physics and stuff like that. And if the philosophers get it wrong, we're not going to all die. But what they do, which would intrigue me and still does, is that they sort of predict the future in a way. They play this what-if game. What if this happened? What if that happened? And they build whole systems on it. And I guess that's my writing.
Well, you've got that ability. You see things that few see, and then they turn out to be true later on. Maybe you're more practical than they are. Maybe you have just more insight. But you're able to look at a puzzle before the pieces are put down.
Yeah, you know, I'm not patting myself on the back or trying to, you know, be, you know, big on my britches, but. Some of this stuff seems to me so obvious. Back in the right after the end of the first Afghanistan war, when bin Laden kicked the Russians out with his Taliban and all that out of Afghanistan, he issued what's called a fatwa, which is a religious order that it was the duty of all Muslims to kill every American man, woman, and child whenever, wherever, and if they died trying or doing it, they're going to go straight to paradise, to heaven. And I was reading about this guy, like in the New York Times or wherever, and I said, this is not some ordinary terrorist. He's well-educated. He's a multi-billionaire. His family is super-connected. The bin Ladens, you know, those big earth-moving equipment that you see on highway projects, most of those were owned by bin Laden Enterprises, his dad, and leased to various people here. And I thought, this guy... And I began to look at him, and there was a fellow by the name of Badansky. I can't remember, recall his first name, but he wrote a book called Osama bin Laden, The Man at War with America. And he was the advisor on bin Laden, these kinds of things, to Congress. Like, come on, these guys know what's going on, and they didn't do a damn thing about it. They just said, oh, yeah, okay, he's a bad guy, and he's very smart. So I thought, okay, this guy will hit us sooner or later. So I wrote a book called Joshua's Hammer that came out before 2001, in which Al-Qaeda does a major strike against the U.S. And I thought against some sort of an iconic place. And I used, instead of the World Trade Center, I used the Golden Gate Bridge. And in all my books, by the way, everything I've written, it never turns out bad because I have a hero, Kirk McGarvey, and he's sort of like Superman.
Saves the day, huh?
Yeah, he saves the day. I wish the hell we had guys like that.
Yeah.
And everybody said, well, how could you predict bin Laden was going to hit us? And I said, well, come on, guys, just open up your eyes. You know, read the newspaper and, you know, read an article one day in the Times, then one on the Washington Post a day later, and then something else a month later, and it sort of sticks at the back of my craw, and I say, like a philosopher, what if this happened? And some of it just seems so inevitable to me.
Well, you know, and you've been right on, spot on, which is kind of scary because you could be spot on again. And your new book out is The Abyss, and we're going to talk a lot about that tonight in some various segments here on the program, David. I want to get your reaction because you do have incredimble insight. Shimon Peres, Israeli president, is saying that it's imminent that they're going to attack Iran. I mean, I've never heard this before of a national leader of a country coming out before anything happens and simply say, it's going to happen. What's your take on this?
Well, first of all, some of that's psychological.
Right.
The Israelis are very good at this. And by the way, they're not alone. We're sort of behind them in the Stuxnet virus.
And by the way, that was Budansky, wasn't it, who wrote that book?
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Okay. A very bright guy. In fact, it's sitting on my bookshelf here someplace.
Okay.
I read that, I don't know how many times, underlined it. But the Israelis do little opening shots. For instance, it was a few months ago, that they did some air training with their jet bombers in an area off the Med, off their coast. And these were practice bomb runs, simulated bomb runs, that had nothing to do with shipping, had nothing to do with any incursion in the border. It had to do, and the whole purpose of these training exercises was to pinpoint hit a target and with deep penetration bombs. And it was obvious to anybody who saw that they were training for a strike on Iran's nuclear facilities.
Mm-hmm.
And they've been asking for, it must be 3 years or 4 years or more for now, from us, from the U.S., bunker-busting bombs. And we have said, no, 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 you can't have them, you don't need them. And about, maybe it's less than a year ago, there was just a small squib somewhere, maybe it was online, or I think it was the New York Times, or maybe Jane's Defense, that said the U.S. was considering honoring the request for busted, and then nothing. So that's kind of speak to me, government speak to me, that, yeah, they've got bunker.
They've got them, yeah.
So number one, Netanyahu's orders this military exercise, but wide open. You know, and they're not trying to hide it. So there's message one to Iran. Message two to Iran, the Stuxnet virus, which is hard to pronounce, but that's put in there in Iran's nuclear program in their centrifuges, which separates the uranium into highly reactive uranium.
It really screwed up their programming, didn't it?
Put them back about a year or two, and that's the crucial part of one of the crucial parts of building a nuclear weapon. So that was number two. And number three, so it's sort of a psychological war. Number three says, we're coming to get you, baby. Hang on. And of course, number four, the U.S., we have really tightened the screws on Iran financially and cut off their bank accounts, their banking, for all practical purposes, outside of Iran. And it's really screwing them up. It's real hamstringing them. So it's sort of like, you know, these are their opening salvos. These are opening shots. And it seems to be working. Ahmadinejad was on TV, I don't know, a few weeks ago, a week ago, crying and bemoaning and saying that they can hardly do business because of the bad guys. And they're also, you can watch all this stuff together. And it's kind of, like you say, it's a jigsaw puzzle. They, in Iranian newspapers, they're having a field day with all this protest that we're having against big banks in the country.
They think it's almost like the Arab Spring here, don't they?
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. And so all this fits together as this sort of a complicated, fluid puzzle, which I find endlessly fascinating.
Talk to a couple guys that I know who are Americans. They moved from Iran years ago, and, you know, they still have family back there. And they are convinced, David, that there will be no war with Iran. They're convinced. And I don't know if it's wishful thinking or what, but they say it's just not going to happen. It's not going to happen. I think otherwise.
Wishful thinking, it really is. The fact of the matter is, and this is part, I'm doing a series of ecological thrillers, and I'm calling them sort of the energy wars group, because we are going to be at war here shortly, starting out with Iran and Venezuela. It may not be an all-out shooting war, because there's some interesting thing that Iran and Venezuela are doing. But any country that is, number one, hostile to us and doesn't even acknowledge the existence, say, of Israel, and they're building nuclear weapons. And they do have rockets to deliver these nuclear weapons. We're going to sit up and take notice.
That's right.
Absolutely. I mean, everybody sort of had their head in the sand with Hitler. But if Hitler had developed a nuclear weapon, let's say in 1940 or 42, it would have been a whole different ballgame. Our response would have been much, much sooner, much quicker. So, I think we're going to war with Iran, but will it be boots on the ground? No, I think we're going to have a different war. These drone things that we're doing, just in a year or so, we've killed 1,500 high Al-Qaeda, important people in Al-Qaeda with drones that some guy sitting back in the state somewhere can control with a joystick. And that may be the future. And there's all sorts of other neat things. Even a boots on the ground, they're trying this. And I can babble on all night, but there's
well, you're on with me all night, so go ahead.
So now we're trying a weapon, which I think this is incredibly cool. I have a friend who was a contractor, and he clues me into all this stuff. There's a weapon that we have. It's a rifle. I think it's 10 millimeter that has a heat seeker built into the head of each bullet.
Like a little missile.
Yeah, like a little missile. And so some guy is hiding behind a wall out there 50 or 100 yards, and he pops out every now and then and fires a bunch of shots. You just fire in the general direction of the wall, and the bullet will go around the corner and hit the guy. I mean, so this is when you say, and I agree with you, George, that there's going to be a war with Iran. It ain't going to be like what we're doing in Afghanistan or Iraq, because Iran is a lot more sophisticated than those guys.
Far more sophisticated than Saddam Hussein was during Desert Storm in 91, right?
Absolutely. I mean, I'm not going to get into this big government debate whether we believe that Saddam had weapons of mass destruction.
Right. Moot point.
Everybody, even Gaddafi had a nuclear program and a a microbial program, and he gave it up. He said, "I did," publicly, and he gave it up at some point. And he realized, just because you have a powerful weapon doesn't mean you're going to be the big kid on the block. Doesn't mean you're going to win. I mean, So there's a lot more complicated stuff going on. I'll write a novel about this one of these days. But let's say, just for the heck of it, that Israeli bombs don't take out their nuclear ambitions. And they do build a nuclear weapon, and they've got, and we can talk about North Korea in a minute, who does have them, and they've got the missile. Now what does Iran do with this nuclear weapon? Do they attach it to a missile, and they fire it on Tel Aviv and wipe out Tel Aviv? Do you realize, and they realize, what would happen to Iran? They'd be wiped off the. They'd be wiped
they'd be
off
gone.
The face of the earth.
They'd be gone.
And so, just to have these fabulously, fabulously expensive toys, isn't the end all to be all. What they are, and this is what we're most afraid of. We're not afraid so much of being attacked. What we're afraid of is the political advantage that having nuclear weapons gives to a country. North Korea. Their people are eating grass soup, for the God's sake.
Yeah.
They're starving to death, and yet they've developed nuclear weapons. They've got five or six of them, something as many as 10 nuclear weapons. Very crude, but it doesn't matter.
And they've got missile capability.
They got three-stage missiles, which is capable of hitting western United States, you know, California, not that area, something as deep as Colorado, probably not. They wouldn't be so, although he's crazy, they wouldn't be so stupid as to use them, but, and this is the point, that gives them this political advantage that we're pussyfooting around. We're not saying get rid of this or do this or else. We're saying, why don't we sit down and talk? And Kim Jong-il says, okay, we'll sit down and talk. And a few months later, he says, oh, the heck with you guys. We're not going to sit down and talk. And so we sit back for a while and fume and give interviews on newspaper and television. And a few months later, he said, well, sir, why don't we sit down and talk? And he'll say, sure, we'll sit down and talk. And nothing ever happens because the guy's got nuclear weapons, which gives him not really military power, because he'd be really stupid to use them, but it gives him political leverage. And so it's a lot more subtle than just, you know, having a big club.
I'm going to do a David Hagberg prediction here. You tell me how close I am.
Yes, sir.
I'm going to even predict in the order of the falling of these countries,
okay,
with some kind of armed conflict or some kind of conflict, maybe something from within. Iran, Syria, Venezuela, and then the last one will be North Korea.
You're not too far off. And there's some more mixed things. I did a piece, I can't remember who I wrote this for, but it's called Flashpoints, that there are some flashpoints. Venezuela is one of them, Iran is one of them, North Korea is one of them, places where if something was back against the wall, and Kim Jong-il is really nuts, and he drinks cognac, by the way. He's got probably one of the most expensive collections of fine cognacs in the entire world, and he watches American Western movies.
He loves those cognac bottles, doesn't he?
Cognac bottles, and he loves watching American Western movies. Go figure that. At any rate, if his back's against the wall, he might lob a missile or two into India, which would be a mess. Venezuela with Chavez and all that are certainly a flashpoint. Another flashpoint I'm thinking is an armed Taiwan. Sooner or later, China's just going to get sick of this, and I'm envisioning a time where somebody puts a finger on a trigger mistakenly and blows one of our cruisers out of the Taiwan Strait. And if they do, there's a big mess there. They can just go after Taipei. But you were pretty right on.
Yeah. I think in that case, China might say, look, you folks are into Iran, Syria, Venezuela. You're trying to get into North Korea. You're in Afghanistan and Iraq. It's our turn.
Yeah. Yep.
And as much as we've got this agreement with Taiwan, I do think we're going to be spread way too thin, and that the Chinese are going to pop into Taiwan in some form or fashion.
Right. We don't have enough boots on the ground. We don't have enough boots to put on the ground anymore, even pulling them all out of Iraq, which may be a mistake. But China, now that's a whole, we could spend 6 days talking about that mess, because China is damned if they do and damned if they don't. Their political aims are quite different than ours all around the world, especially in that region, North Korea, who they're ashamed of.
And we're their best client.
That's right. We're their biggest trading partner. Not only that, they hold, I don't know, $1 trillion worth of our debt, our government bonds. So, I mean, if they go to war with us, they're just wiping out this whole huge amount of money that is coming their way, is that owed to them. I mean, if the guy down the street owes me, $100,000, I don't know if I'm going to really badmouth him so bad. As a matter of fact, I might even try to help him with his new job or new invention so he's going to make enough money to pay me back.
Exactly. You want to help him.
It's a really complicated, which is, as an old Chinese proverb said, it's a curse. May you live in interesting times. And it's a curse. Well, we sure the hell live in interesting times. Bad for people, very good for writers.
Yeah, that is so true, David. So true indeed. Let's talk a little bit about this envision you see of a major war, which we've been hinting about here. But you also see it over energy, don't you?
Excuse me. Yeah, it's a war not so much like World War II or even like Iran or Iraq. It's going to be a lot more subtle than that, much more technical. And the energy war is only the start. It's going to be a water war coming our way, too. And I think all this is going to come to fruition well within 10 years. The fact of the matter is, whether you believe it or don't believe it, and a lot of conservatives don't, that we're warming up the planet. The planet is warming up naturally, but we as human, our human intervention is warming up the planet. We're pumping CO2. Us, China, and India is coming online by burning coal.
We're helping a natural cycle along.
We're helping a natural cycle, and it couldn't come at a worse time, because we're in 100,000-year cycles of carbon dioxide, which we're coming into that cycle again. And we're also, the sun, I've just been reading about this, the sun does not produce just a steady amount of energy. It fluctuates.
That's right, and that's one of the reasons. Hey, David, hold on. We're going to hit this break pretty soon, and I want to come back and we'll talk more about your thoughts about this next war and just what's happening all over the place. David's latest book is called Abyss, and his website is linked up at coasttocoastam.com. And we're talking to the Nostradamus of novelists, David Hagberg. His latest work, by the way, is called Abyss. And we'll be back with David in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And we've returned. David Hagberg with us on Coast to Coast AM. David, so let's review this possibility of a major war over energy. Go ahead.
The fact of the matter is, energy, obviously, energy is running everything, electricity, let's say. And in this country, 47% of all the electricity that's produced is produced by burning coal, which is really dirty. And there's only maybe 100 years, if that, of oil in the ground, and using oil and petroleum products to run cars, planes, boats, and trains is really stupid in the long run, because we're going to run out of oil. We're obviously going to run out of oil. I want to get it complicated real quick here shortly. Nuclear energy is problematic, because even a small nuclear power plant puts out about 9,000 metric tons of highly radioactive waste mm-hmm. every year, and there's no place to store it. So in most cases, this stuff is stored in concrete-lined barrels right on site. So if you got a nuclear plant anywhere near you, you know there's just tons and tons of nuclear waste that's going to be deadly for 100,000-plus years. Now it's going to get a little more complicated, because hydroelectric seems to be a nice, clean way to do things, but with global warming, and whatever causes global warming, I have my ideas, is causing snowpack, and glaciers to shrink. And melting glaciers and melting snowpack runs down the rivers, goes through dams, and produces electricity. So we've got a little spurt for now, but it's going to be over here shortly. Windmills are fine, but they're noisy as hell, and the wind doesn't blow all the
right.
time.
And you need 100,000 of them all over the place, don't you?
Yes, and solar cells, solar energy is still in its infancy, and the problem with solar cells, and you're finding it on these Mars rovers, is that the solar mirrors, the part that receives the sun, get dusty.
They get dusty. You got to clean them.
And you got to clean them. Well, clean, you know, 500 acres of these things, and you've got a big job, and they're tender. They get so. Where does all this energy come from? There's two possible ways. there's one on these massive programs of mining energy from the sea, which is what my book Abyss is about. You can put tens of thousands of windmills, and I've designed a new windmill that instead of rotating blades, they have gigantic bird wings, which just flap, they turn into the breeze, and they flap like birds. They don't make any noise. You can make them pink and purple, and it'll look pretty. But the fact of the matter is, and this is what clued me into this whole thing. This is this little thing that sort of stuck way in the back of my mind. I can't remember the guy's first name, but he's Saudi Arabia's minister of oil. His last name is El Naimi, and he went to the original George Bush, and the first George Bush, who was pushing alternative energy, and this was in the Washington Post, and he said, take care, Mr. President, with any kind of an alternative energy thing, because our lives, our livelihood, is dependent upon
oil.
You buying oil. We have nothing else. There's no tourism or anything like
right.
that.
Right, no industry, so nothing.
Yep. No, if you really push this alternative energy, we're going to have to do other things. And we know that China and we know that emerging India will buy our fuel. So be very, very careful what you do. And that, honest to God, slowed down our alternative energy research. So what's going to happen, and all these OPEC countries are saying the same thing to us, we're caught between, you know, a rock and a hard place. And any person who is, like, if somebody comes into my home and backs me in a corner, I'm going to fight back. Well, we are rapidly getting backed into a corner as a country. So we're trying all electric vehicles, but all electric vehicles take electricity, which means we've got to produce the electricity somehow.
And we've got an antiquated grid, don't we?
We can spend all night talking about that, too. So sooner or later, countries like Venezuela, who hate us anyway, and countries like Iran, who hate us, and Saudi Arabia, who
Who hate us, but they don't tell us that directly.
Yeah, they hate us and they love us because they need the money.
Yeah, exactly.
And sooner or later, we're going to get into some sort of a furball, some sort of a dust-up. We have a program on the books, that we deny, but we do have the program on the books called Operation Balboa, which Venezuela only has 7 really decent forward air bases from which they can launch American-made fighter jets, by the way, into the air. And our Operation Balboa, which the Venezuelans have always thought we were going to use to take down the government, it's just going to wipe out those 7 forward air bases, which would deny Chavez air power. Well, if we did that, he's going to strike back. The only way he really knows how is by cutting off the oil spigots. That's not that important. I think he's either the 4th or 5th. He's number 4 or 5 in oil suppliers. Sure. So Canada's first, Mexico's 2, Saudi Arabia.
But he's got, thousands of Citgo gas stations here, doesn't he?
Yes, he does. So he can pull the plug on those. And so these are the kinds of things. These are the kinds of opening shots of a war, but if people keep knocking at our borders, we're going to have to do something more than Operation Balboa. And you know, it all ties in what we were talking about in the first segment with Iran and the Stuxnet virus, and now bunker busting bombs for Israelis, and so we hit Iran. Sooner or later, that's going to have to happen, and we agree on that.
Yeah, with Chavez, I think are we going to wait until he dies of cancer?
There's a couple of guys waiting in the wings who are as bad as... There's a couple of guys who are more pro-democracy, and Chavez and his people keep knocking them down, arresting them. There was one assassination a few months ago, so that's going to get to be more complicated. But, so energy. We're going to fight over energy. We're going to fight over water later. We're going to fight over energy. And here is where we're extraordinarily vulnerable.
Now, is this a prediction or is this the novelist speaking?
I guess it's a little bit of both. But this is, again, an article somewhere in the Wall Street Journal sometime in 2009 sort of stuck in the back of my head, which is part of what's the genesis of this energy wars thing I'm talking about. The FBI cyber crimes unit and the CIA has a similar unit at some point found out that, and we're going to talk about the grid, our power grid in a minute, that the way electrical power is shunted around the country is runs through 600 different control centers, and all by computers. And these computers, we find out, have been infected with a very, very sophisticated virus. This is true stuff. A virus that's so sophisticated, it has to have come either from Russia or China. They're the only countries with that capability.
The virus is in the system now?
Right now, since before 2009. That means with a push of a button, they could shut down all electricity in the United States. That's an interesting thought. But China, of course, and Russia deny it. And our cyber crimes unit and some of our best minds say, well, we'll remove the virus. Well, they can't.
But they know it's in there.
They know it's in there. They know all about it. And if they attempted to remove the virus, it's like a house of cards, taking the bottom card out, the whole mess would become tumbling down. And the best analysts say, well, China or Russia aren't going to use this. They're not going to push the button unless it came to some sort of a war. Right, unless our backs were against the wall, their backs were against the wall, and they pushed the button, and all the electricity across the United States would fail. So in a book that I'm working on right now with Senator Byron Dorgan from North Dakota, I've got anything's for sale. You and I know that. Anything is for sale. So an angry Iran, Savak, their secret service, gets a hold of a disgruntled Russian engineer, and they buy
this
copy of a virus.
Yeah.
And they share it with Venezuela. And the point is, they're going to drop all our electricity as a retaliatory measure. And it will be far, far easier than you can imagine because our electrical grid is possibly the worst on the entire planet. It is a total mess.
Well, let me tell you one of the problems, too, David, and you've seen this, and I've witnessed this just in St. Louis, when lightning hits a transformer, there aren't a lot of those things available.
No, and we're talking about not those little cans that sit up on the top
right.
of the pole.
Right, we're talking about the big ones.
The big ones, and we don't make them in this country. They're made overseas in China, I guess some, but Germany makes these things. And there's a three-year waiting list for them. So if a transformer is knocked out, we don't have many spares. And there's only just a few hundred of them that do all this work across the country. If you knocked out a half a dozen of those alone with a little sabotage. And these things, they're prone to lightning. But these big things, you know, they're like the size of about the size of a two-car garage. These things are not guarded. They're behind, you know, barbed wire fences.
That's right.
Fence. But there's, I mean, you'd be pretty stupid to climb over a fence into a facility that's got a couple hundred thousand volts running to it. Unless you're on a suicide mission, you lob a bomb over and you wipe it out. It would be really screwed up. So when I was talking earlier about this energy wars, this is how it will start. But let's get back a minute to this grid because. I've been learning about this, and this is just, you know, the more I read, my mouth drops open. And I say, come on, I could not have invented this.
Well, and explain this to us, David, the okay. grid, so people can understand how this works.
Well, I'll try to make it simple. All what right. happens is the people who produce the power stations and all that, they don't own the high-voltage transmission line, those great big honking things that you see going across country when you're driving. Those are the transmission line, and they hook this thing up. It's called a grid. And that means plants that generate electricity all over the United States produce, and wind turbines and any nukes, anything that produces electricity, gets plugged in to a high voltage line somewhere which runs across the country. Now, ideally, let's say wind turbines in California, if they're producing a little extra energy, all that electricity could go on these high wire lines, and a computer would direct that. Let's say this power was needed in New York City because it's hot, and so the power would go there. But that's not the way that's the way it works everywhere else, not in our country.
We can't do that, can we?
No, we cannot do that. We have three interconnects, they're called. All the power that's generated by power stations in the eastern United States, from about the Dakotas east, so I'm roughly the Mississippi east, is all connected together, from Maine to Florida all. So if somebody in Florida has a little extra power, they can ship it up to Minneapolis. Or in Des Moines, if they get a little extra power, they can ship it to South Carolina and New York. All that works just fine. Excuse me.
Okay.
But there is also the Western Interconnect. That's a group of high transmission lines west from the northern United States. Canada's in the mix there, all the way to Southern California. So if Los Angeles needs a little extra power, they can get it from Nevada. But Los Angeles cannot get it from Minneapolis, right? So they're not connected, these two. So everything on the West Coast has to deal with the West Coast. Everything on the East Coast has to deal with the East Coast. And then Texas, all by itself, has their own, the Texas Interconnect. And Texas cannot transmit power, excess power, up to New York or up to places like that. Now, to complicate matters, there is no one federal authority that has any teeth to run all these, coordinate all these, all this big mess. And the whole big mess is run by 600 different control centers that don't all talk to each other. And the thing with electricity is you can't store it effectively. You can't have like big batteries to store the power from, let's say, a nuclear power plant. Whenever power is needed, that's when it has to be produced. And if you produce power that's not needed, then it doesn't go into the grid. They shut down the turbine.
We don't have the capacitor to do that.
We don't have the capacity for that. So a lot of times these wind farms in California, they have to shut the things down. The electricity has nowhere to go on the grid, even though they desperately need it, let's say, in Des Moines. Now, I couldn't make that stuff up, and it's even more complicated than that because...
And how old is this system, David?
Yeah, well, a lot of this has started out in the 1800s.
Oh, my gosh,
late 1800s, and we stopped using using copper long, long, long ago. We use aluminum, or spinal aluminum.
That's right.
And aluminum does oxidize. It rusts in the air, and it sags. So curves, you know, from the power line from one power pole or pylon to the next, they sag. And as they get older, they sag more and more, and sooner or later they sag enough to touch metal or touch ground, and you got that mess. It's almost as bad as the air traffic control system. Some of the computers are so antiquated that guys write orders on slips of paper and pass it from council to council. And the fact is, if all of a sudden it's a warmer than predicted night in Manhattan and they need a bunch of electricity, we may not have the electricity to send to them, which is why the brownouts, and they call them rolling brownouts. The computer will say in one control center, well, they need a lot of extra electricity in New York. We don't have enough to give them. So what we're going to do is reduce electricity in New Jersey for a little while, and an hour later we're going to reduce electricity here, an hour later reduce electricity here. And if there is one relay that doesn't click, one computer that goes down, then you have a blackout, massive blackout.
And we've seen that happen.
And that's just the start. Now, okay, with all that said, if I wanted to start a war with the United States, that's the first place I'd hit, where we're vulnerable, our underbelly.
Yes.
That's
what we do, right?
Absolutely. That's the natural way. That's the way to do things. And what astounds me is that we're not rebuilding the computers piece by piece. Now, we're going to get into money in a minute. We're not rebuilding computers piece by piece. We're not building factories to build these transformers that are so desperately needed. They're the ones, a power plant, you know, produces, let's say, a voltage of only 10,000 volts, and it's a high amperage. So they have this big transformer that steps that voltage up from 10,000 volts up to 750,000 volts. And that's the stuff that goes on the big high power lines across country. At the other end, wherever they end up, where they're going to be distributed, another big transformer takes that 750,000 volts and brings it back down to 10,000 volts. And those are the big transformers that are vulnerable. You take out those, you have no way of sending energy from across this grid, this fractured grid.
Well, and you say there are no backups.
There are no backups, and it's astounding.
You can't wheel in a new transformer.
And it astounds me, George, we're not buying them. We're not ordering them and putting them in a warehouse someplace against
this. Oh, my God, yeah. That should be just like the nation's oil reserves.
Thank you. So we're going to war. We know it's going to be a ground war, and we're going to need tanks, so let's buy some tanks and some rifles and some bullets. So we're not doing it. We're not doing it, and I don't – again, I've talked to Bob.
That is amazing.
About this, and he said, I can't believe this, Dave. And I said, I can't believe it either. I mean, it's national. It's I don't know, national crying shame, if you want. We're leaving ourselves vulnerable and saying, okay, I'm leading my chin out here. My guard is down. Punch me, if you will. And it's going to happen.
Why isn't anybody smart enough to do this?
You know, okay, here, let's get back to the money thing. It's hubris and it's greed. I thought to myself, we live in Florida. We moved into a house, it's about 6 years ago. And it was for sale or for lease. And I can't remember the cost, like $399, let's say it was. And I'm just some novelist sitting here in Florida. And I said, no, I think what we're going to do is lease this house. We'll rent it for a while.
Don't have to come up with a down payment in your
We're going toward a real estate bubble. I could see that. That was obvious. That was obvious as the day is long.
Yeah.
So this $399,000 house has gone down to $179,000.
Wow.
So had I bought that, even put $100,000 down at $299,000, I'd still be underwater. Now, of course, the people don't want to sell the house. I don't blame them. But look, I'm not a financial guru. I'm just a novelist. And, you know, Bob calls me Nostradamus, but it's more national things, that international things.
Well, hold on, Nostradamus. We're going to hit this break, David. We're going to come right back with you in just a moment as we talk more about things you see in the future.